Hello, and welcome to the TAA teleconference. You want to write a textbook? Here's how to do it. Presented by Robert Christofferson, Professor Emeritus of Geography at American River College. Robert is the author of the leading physical geography textbooks in the U.S. and Canada, all published by Pearson Prentice Hall. He and his nature photographer wife, Bobby, have completed 9 expeditions to the Arctic and Antarctic regions since 2003, gathering information and photos for his books. Geosystems, now in its 7th edition, won a TAA Textbook Excellence Award in 1998. Elemental Geosystems, now in its 5th edition, won a Textbook Excellence Award in 2005. Geosystems Canadian Edition, now in its 2nd edition, and Applied Geography, now in its 7th edition. Robert was recognized for excellence in teaching with the 1999 Distinguished Teaching Achievement Award from the National Council for Geographic Education and the Outstanding Educator Award from the California Geographical Society in 1997. TAA presented him with its President's Award in 2005. He has spoken across the U.S. and Canada to hundreds of colleges, groups, and professional meetings. I now turn the teleconference over to Robert Christofferson.
Well, thank you, Ginny, and welcome to everyone that has phoned in and in response to my annotated narrative outline. I appreciate the kind comments, but I'm a work in progress. This is a very personal thing, writing a textbook, and I would say that most of you could probably conduct this exact same teleconference with your own personal experience. So I don't make any pretense about having unlocked some mystery or figured something out. I'm a student of the process. I kind of like Thomas Alva Edison's approach, that you set the physical structure of the lab, the writing studio, and everything up, and then the creation happens. So please keep that in mind. All right, in response to the outline, let's go down the points and then break in at any point if you do have a question. And we can follow up the discussion at San Antonio in June. First of all, writing and in the textbook format is very a creative process. I found it very stimulating. And when I would go into class to teach, I found that as I was talking, I would have more words on my palate, that it seemed to infuse the teaching with, examples, words, vocabulary. It supported and was a strong corollary. It sets up a whole structure in your life, and that helps focus things. And, of course, as I said, it's a very personal process, so each of you will set up your own organization, uniting together all the different aspects of your teaching, research, and writing. And, therefore, it's a very rewarding process personally and possibly financially as well. However, the money, the commission checks or whatever, if that is a sole motivation, I think the isolation and workload quickly frustrates that motivation. And I've always felt it was best that I set that aside and got all of the structure and organization, the unity of my approach together. Be organized throughout the process. I know I've just finished 4 books in the last 24 months, and my office looks like barbarians have invaded and blown everything up, because under deadlines, lost things, a mess just becomes a bigger mess. And so I always try to start the morning out with a quick sorting. And I believe that you should get text-specific letterhead and business cards made as one of the initial steps in your writing process, so that you begin responding with letterhead. This can be electronic letterhead, and your business cards are available for handing to people, putting out at professional meetings, and the cards say the name of your book with some representative icon. The writing studio is extremely important. My college had a copyright stipulation that copyrightable materials written in my office at school, the school would get half the royalties. So I've been in a home office situation for a long time. Some of you may have various versions of that with your colleges. Well, I recommend a home writing studio because of the time away from family, because of the isolation, the weekends, the holidays, the Christmas break, because it just keeps you with the family environment and away from the way our campus offices operate with interruptus going on most of the time. So your writing studio should be a dedicated space for you and for IRS tax purposes. So it's set up with all your idiosyncrasies and what you need. And so I won't go into doing further arguments about that. I just highly recommend it because of the blocks of time required. Have large surface areas. And if you're all electronic, then you don't need manuscript staging areas quite the same way. If you're still into physical manuscript, then these sorting areas help all of your reference books set up, and this would be on your bookmarks as well as your physical reference books. I still like to use glossaries in Chicago Manual of Style and physical things and not just be all electronic. We took one of the rooms at our home and designed cabinets and bookshelves and a console around the computer monitor, so you've got a place to stage and lay things out. Well, that would be the second thing I would list on my little outline, the idea of the writing studio, a dedicated space attached to the living area. The teaching to develop an outline. In your teaching, you develop a better way to do something, a better way to teach, a better way to explain and communicate, maybe even a venture with some papers at professional meetings of the new approach, and take that and begin to develop that as an outline. Now, as you look at the competition in your field, you see all the things you don't like, and so you can identify those, but move quickly to see what you do like. What are the new features of your book? And the classroom becomes a crucible for the outline. I can remember having two or three back-to-back lecture sections and would try it in two different orders or three different orders to see what worked best in the logic sequence and to teach it and experiment with it. These things become the key element in your prospectus that you would submit to editors, where you've got this detailed three-order headline and description of why it's organized that way and why you found it to work that way. Outlining is easier than writing, and I mentioned that in the paragraph that if you it's easy to talk about writing a book, and it's easy to outline writing a book, and then the actual writing of it is a totally different thing. And I know all of you who have tried this can sense that. It's just different when the pedal hits the metal and the rubber hits the road. any thoughts about just that basic idea of the writing studio, developing the outline, the approach? Is that just pretty clear cut?
Yeah, it sounds really good. Hello, my name is Judy, and I just wanted to say I like the idea of the text-specific letterhead and business cards. I hadn't thought of that, and I think that's a great idea.
Absolutely. When you go to professional meetings and your book is published, I put out on the front shelves of the booth in front of my books, I put out the card. And we got a P.O. box, so our street address is not disclosed, and the number goes to a specific cell phone. that I can track for phone messages. The home phone's not on there.
Mm-hmm.
And it has the icon, a tie-in icon. Mine's a mariner's compass that's embossed.
Mm-hmm.
And that just signals to everybody that you're serious and you're there to help them with your email address on the card.
Mm-hmm.
In my teleconference last fall, I talked about putting your email address in the preface of your book. I don't know why other authors don't do this generally, but for at least 10 years now, this has been an incredible dynamic, fluid contact between the market, the users, the adopters, and me. And that email address can be on the business cards. So, and I've never found it abusive. I might get six a week. There might be a few more near finals time where students will have questions, but that goes on that business card too. Well, in terms of the market, don't start your book project in a void. Know the market. Even if you have to lay out money to get competing text, know the competition. Know who the publishers are in the field. Prepare a comparative spreadsheet. Aligned in landscape mode, and you would have the different books and then columns on the length, appendancy features, pedagogical elements, boxed features, layout, specifics about content. Like there might be, in my field, there are applied topics like climate change, sea level rise, earthquake prediction. And so I would have columns on the spreadsheet for those specific areas, then the innovations that your book is doing, some new theory, some new hypothesis about your field, have a column of that. And then as you go through the market, the other books, start filling the sheet in, and immediately you'll start seeing holes develop where the competition is not doing what your innovation is doing. And the spreadsheet, it may end up 5 pages long, but I found to be a valuable tool, a valuable focusing tool. You don't want to use the competing books for reference. They're out of date, but you do want to sample their coverage and confine what they don't have. Now, later, when your book is published and the marketing people come back to you and ask, we're competing against so-and-so at the adoption and at this state university, what do you know about that book? You can go back to the spreadsheet, and it's easy to compose a quick marketing response back to them using what you found out when you did this initial survey. So this puts you in touch with the field of play. And don't forget Canada. Don't think of your book as ending at the 49th parallel. If your discipline is at Canadian colleges and universities, then include that. My book has metric conversions throughout where it's expressed in metric with English units in parentheses. And, of course, don't forget the Canadian spelling. If your book is U.S.-based, you would have it in the American spellings, and it would be used in Canada. There's no need to paraphrase or put parenthetical C-O-L-O-U-R spellings. But if you come out with a specific Canadian edition subsequently, going through and adjusting the metric units and spellings, that'll be necessary. So don't forget Canada in your market analysis. Find out the presence of it there. It's a smaller market than here, but it's market. Have a style guide for your textbook. And on the first edition, this will be tentative and developmental and evolving at best. I've written over 30 books, and my style guide is still evolving. But use Chicago Manual of Style 15th edition as a base, but then develop specifics that relate to your field. This could be specific ways that you want to see numbers, dates, and symbols used. The kinds of dashes you want to use, N and M dashes, specifics about abbreviation, how you want to see those handled, punctuation and italics. It's very important that if you have a foreign word that has diacritical marks, if those aren't there, that word is misspelled. And this would include Hawaiian spellings as well, with their glottal stops and diacritical marks. Now, this is a wrestling match with copy editors, but in your style guide, you can refer to these diacriticals as the way that you want the spelling to be. This makes the detail authentic when the adopter is looking through and they can see that Alazizia and Marohoro Vikic has the diacriticals on it, a little detail. There may be some general things and specific situations that are discipline-specific to you. And in my book, I have to have lists of geographical names and how I want them spelled. Then for specific word usage, you can even have an alphabetical column set in your style guide where Ice Age as a noun is two words and as an adjective is hyphenated, that type of thing. Only
I have a question.
The terms as they would relate to your...
Hello?
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? You're talking about the Chicago Manual. Most of the stuff that I've done has been done with the other APA.
Yeah, we'll use that then. But I would obtain a copy of the Chicago Manual style because generally that's the one the publishers are using. I would have
The last book I published was... I know both of them. I know the Tribune. I know all that. But it's best to ask the publisher first, right?
Sure. But you'll generally find that they've never received a style guide from an author. And so you're entering into new territory. And the purpose of having a dedicated style guide for your book, mine's only about 15 pages long, is that when it comes to copy editing and production editing and page proofing, everybody's on the same wavelength, and you don't get back copy-edited material where they've changed a style that you want in your field. I mean, that wastes so much time. So I think you'll find the publisher will tell you generally Chicago, but they might say APA, and then you produce your own guide custom to your own book. I just mentioned Chicago not as mandatory, but it's the most widespread. I would also include in your style guide the footnote style, photo credits, how you want that laid out. And I think that's an important thing that down the road helps focus everybody, including yourself. On our outline, we go to the computer, and my experience has been that production graphics and art people seem to be in Mac. The acquisition editors and the frontline seem to be in PC, but generally Mac and PC can read each other, and that doesn't pose a problem. We find Mac is more flexible and good with the satellite images and graphics and photographs that I have to work with, but... we've never had that problem. So whether you're PC or Mac, try to set up folders for each book, and the folders separate into each chapter. And in the folder, you would have the outline, the text, the key terms, the figure captions, the URL lists. You would have a front matter folder, an in matter folder, chapters for the instructor's resource manual, the student study guide, and you'd have these folders so that when you're working on a chapter, there might be six documents open on the screen. Then set up the folders for editor, correspondence, production, permissions, photo and image research, source materials, outlines, the cover design, a review folder, and all these are under the book. So it's just like, and I know I'm stating the obvious, it's just like organizing your desktop on your physical desk. Then there'd be folders for first pass, second pass, third pass page proofs if you're doing these in PDFs. And if they allow you to look at final proofs or soft proofs or the printer files, that would be an additional folder. So set the desktop up so that you've got this dynamic workspace with the documents open. so that you can be working on the text, adding to your key terms list, writing the figure captions as you insert the figures, correcting the outline, all on the fly. It's a great mistake to work on text only and then add the figures later, do the glossary later, write the figure captions after. By having this on an integrated desktop, your figures, your captions, your credit lines, your text become more integrated, and you'll find that adopters will be commenting on how the students were able to flow through the chapter because the figures related to the words and the words related to the caption, and it was tied together. And I see that integration as being a byproduct of the way your computer desktop is set up. It just works that way. I would recommend a large cinema monitor, a flat panel monitor, and go with the 30-inch because you're going to have a lot of documents open at the same time to get that feeling of integration. I don't know, you've all probably had the same experience that I did, that when I went from a CRT monitor to a flat panel, I found the eye strain just disappeared. And I don't know what it is. I'm not a doctor, but I found that that helped. And it helped to be able to have a bunch of stuff open at once. Of course, this means fast internet links as well. Try to have the latest versions of MS Word, Adobe Acrobat, Photoshop CS3, other software that you need for your field. But be careful when you update software to check with production about getting ahead of them. Sometimes you might get a version ahead, and that can be difficult. But,
hello, I have a question.
Yeah.
I've been writing my text in LaTeX. Is that something that's valuable to them or not? I keep hearing different stories.
You would have to ask them, so I don't know.
All right.
Who is that?
This is Robert Paz at New Mexico State.
No, but is it Microsoft? Is it Adobe? Is it?
No, LaTeX is an open source. It's like a standard for a lot of scientific publishing.
Huh. Well, then in your field, that would be what you would use, and you'd still set up your desktop the same way with all these documents open and simultaneously, right?
Right.
Yeah. And it's LETEC?
LATEX.
LATEX. And who's the manufacturer?
It's open source.
Open source, okay.
It was it's used a lot for science and math,
yeah.
Engineering.
And your publisher has an ability to run that?
I believe most publishers, from what I understand, actually have the capability of using that.
Yeah.
LaTeX is not really a word processor. It's actually a typesetting program.
Huh. Interesting.
So,
well, that hasn't come up with Pearson, so I'll ask about it. Thanks for the lead.
You're welcome.
I mentioned here about figure and permission tracking logs. Most contracts will give you.
Last question. Just an interruption on the last question. The publisher says they want it in PDF format. And the illustrations in, I forgot the name of the program, but I have it written down somewhere. But in any case, you need to ask the publisher or the printer what kind of printer they use.
When you're submitting photographs, the printing protocols that you have to set in Photoshop CS3 are sometimes unknown by the publisher, and so you will be submitting RGB files, and they will convert to CMYK, and there is a problem there in quality and color control. So that's something to check with your production editor. The PDF he mentioned, Adobe Acrobat PDF, all of the page proofs for the last 6 or 7 books I've done have been all electronic PDF files. And there are low res and high res that you'll get to proof and do electronic markup editing on the pass. So you're actually looking at page proofs. in PDF, and I found that to be really grand, even if we had to redo compositing and layout in a chapter to get it to a flow better. That's Adobe Acrobat PDF, and I'm sure all of you know about that and have used it on books. The photographs are submitted RGB. Research and writing. This is very personal, and it's up to each of you, but I really believe in broadsheets, large sheets of paper. They're on pads about 2 feet by 3 feet, and they have a 4-square-per-inch grid on them. And I, as I'm searching around, will take notes and mark up on these broadsheets, and then when I go to compose a section, I'll put the broadsheets around, and it just is much better than note cards or anything, but that's a personal thing. Lay out the key terms and concepts before you start writing the chapter so that you already have the road signs on the road you're going to travel on marked out ahead of time. Decide on the number of complex and simple arts for the chapter before you begin. Sketch them out. I use ink and color pencil, but have sketches of these so that as you're writing, it embraces and hugs the artwork so that you get this integration feel again, that things weren't tacked on at the end. So there's a lot of preliminary stuff to lay out, just like a blueprint with an architect to build a building. And key terms, concepts, behavioral objectives, and having the complex and simple arts mapped out ahead of time. Two or three orders of headings. I've been amazed when I go through other books and find that one chapter will have three orders of headings, another chapter will have one order of heading, and it's inconsistent throughout the book. That throws the students off. So decide at the outset if you're going to have two or three orders of heads, and then have your outline laid out in those three orders, and then write to that as you flesh out the headings. But decide on that before you ever start writing. Develop clipping idea problem files that are keyed to outline headings, that once you get these outline headings, then they become tab labels in your filing system. So every time you go through a professional journal or get a lead or there's an article in the newspaper or something, you put it into those headings. A question comes in from a student or you get an email about something, that goes into the clipping file. The next point I make there is just throw up that first draft. Don't micromanage. Don't try to get the paragraph perfect. But kind of blast through with all the preliminary work you've got. Do that first one as a no-fault draft to get it on screen. And then with your notation broadsheets, your preliminary art, your photo and image ideas, your outline headings, your key terms, what's going to be bold-faced, the behavioral objectives for the chapter. I'm still one of those people that believes in having key learning concepts written as complex behavioral objectives at the beginning of the chapter. And then at the end of the chapter, the summary and review is organized around those behavioral objectives. I don't think those are passé at all. I think the student needs to know what they need to know when they're going to read this chapter. The idea that you record and then type up a lecture, I just don't know anybody that I've talked to that knows that that works, because when you're lecturing, you've got your eyebrows, your voice inflection and modulation, you've got hand gestures, you're positioning your body. When you're writing, it's only the words, and all that stuff, all the eyebrow index and all the hand gestures have to be built into the words. And so that's where I think composing can't be a recording of a lecture. But perhaps you have had a different experience with that. That's just a personal statement. When you're typing in your writing studio, if the writing studio in your mind's eye is filled with colleagues and other professors and quit writing, kick them out of the office. You want to have the writing studio filled with virtual students with curious faces, and because you're writing to them, don't be afraid of the thought that, wow, if I write it at this introductory level, my colleagues will think that's all I know. That's a common mental thing that people go through. Have the virtual students surrounding you be writing with their faces in mind, not colleagues, not graduate advisors, not professional people that are demanding the calisthenic pedantic stuff. Okay, on your screen, I already mentioned about having everything open, like the glossary, the key terms, the outline, figure captions, so that you are doing those on the fly as you compose, and you're not waiting till the end to stick them all in. I think that's a key dynamism to writing in this day and age of computers. And set up a preparation file immediately for the next edition where you begin accumulating. So even if you're on a three-year revision cycle, working on your book is a daily ongoing thing. And I call those preparation folders, but you could call them any type of thing. A sample chapter for your prospectus. The supporting pedagogy has got to be in there, the way the summary and review is done, the way the behavioral objectives. Have the key learning concepts. You know, after reading this chapter, you should be able to, and then list your behavioral objectives. A little introduction. I have a thing after the introduction that's called In This Chapter, which gives them a quick, succinct overview. Then you've got the text, and that's integrated with Art's photo all together. The captions manuscript with credit lines. I put credit lines right with captions because I found it's part of the pedagogy. I have fought with publishers over the years to not have the credits grouped at the end of the book, but to have them with the captions. I think that's important. A few boxed features, but don't overdo that. If you have features in the news or in depth or a focus study or however you refer that, that highlight specific applied issues to your field, that relieves the text of that. And then the summary and review, I already mentioned that organize those around the behavioral objectives. I have a problems or critical thinking section at the very end. So that takes it the next step. So I've got a paragraph in there, pedagogical support goals. The key learning concepts help the student determine what she or he wants to know, wants to learn. The text guides the student in developing information and more questions. Summary and review assesses what the student has learned and what more the student might want to know about the subject. And then the critical thinking section provokes action and application. So it builds the chapter structure. Now, however you design yours, in the prospectus that goes to an editor, they will be very impressed at the concepts and the layout, the proactivity that you have put into that sample chapter. Be involved in the book design and the color palette. Make sure the publisher's aware that you want to do that, that they just don't drop it on you. And this is something that you leverage more as you get into later editions. But think through what you want the cover to say, what the back cover would say. Design something for the inside front cover and inside back cover. That's a powerful pedagogical space that can really set up something for your book. I mean, it could be some integrative table. I've got an image of Earth, all the continents during the day, and then an inset of the continents at night. And inside the back, I've got a physical map. But your field will have what you want in it. It might be a big bubble diagram or a flow chart, but don't forget the inside front and back cover. And fight to have that used. If it has an image of something, then you want to get into requesting coated paper for the inside cover so it pops the color. That's a separate decision with your editor. But so be involved in the book design, the color palette, they'll have a preliminary color palette that they can send you as a PDF file, and you can look through. I won't get into the issue in book design about two column or one column or whatever, but I like the flexibility of two column and the way of doing 20 pica wide quarter page photos or images, and there's just greater flexibility, and one column just has too much air, but you know, that's a personal thing. Have the ancillaries in mind as you're working, things that can go in a student study guide. Think of the student study guide as a personal tutorial between you and the student. And the IRM, Instructor's Resource Manual, which today they have as an IR DVD. Think about that, and what a PowerPoint of your book would be, a skeletal PowerPoint that the adopter could, you know, add to and subtract from and whatever.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Backing up a little bit, can we talk about the index?
Go for it.
So how does the index usually happen?
Well, normally, at least in my experience, the publisher pays for the index, and you should get an index file that you actually proofread and mark up and proofread it for spellings, for depth, for additional material that needs to be listed. And with Adobe Acrobat PDFs, you can quickly find page numbers. However, on the very first edition, my wife and I did our own index, and it was laborious on little teeny 9-inch screens and the works. But the reason we did it was to set the style that we wanted to have subheadings in our index. We just didn't want to have first order headings only. And so we did the first one, and the publishers have done all subsequent ones. The indexer must have your style guide for the diacriticals and the marks and your basic ideas of how you want it set up. But my experience is the publisher pays for that.
Okay, thank you.
But just make sure you get to proofread.
Okay.
To where you delete, and in the last book I just had done, we came out about 92 lines long, and so it did not end up on the last recto page of the book, and so they came back to me and said, you've got to cut 92 lines. So here I go through this 11-page index and cut off. And, of course, for an author, that's like cutting off your baby's fingernails and toes and all this stuff. So that was really a index is an interesting thing, and take it seriously just like it's text. And it's at the end of the process, and you're really tired, so it becomes a test of will. Developmental editing and reviews embrace all input from strangers. Way back on my first edition, when I got the 12 reviews they had done of my first manuscript, I sat down and did a review of the reviewers and bounced it right back to the publisher, and that sold them on signing me for a contract, that I took the reviewers so seriously that I reviewed them. A developmental editor, a DE, is something your publisher might invest in, and this is someone who looks through the competition, who looks through your manuscript, who reads it kind of like a student would read it and comes back to you with detailed comment, developmental editing. And that's something to ask for. They're not reviewers, but they're developmental editors to help you with that. Another thing is focus groups. It's a possibility that your publisher would bring together a group of users to sit around a table at some hotel and have an all-day cathartic thing. And let me tell you, as an author, these are very rewarding and exhausting, but important. I wish my publisher did more focus groups. Now, without
Excuse
a focus
me, can
group,
I
yeah.
ask a question, please?
Yeah.
I wanted to just go back really quickly to the previous topic. Think of complimentary shrink wraps. Could you please talk just a little bit about that? I'm not familiar with that at all.
Well, let's say that your book marketed in North America, that you set up the idea for having a regional supplement where you would have a couple of academics from the Southeast, the Southwest, New England, the Midwest, and you would pick up some articles that support the book with regional specifics.
Oh.
And then those would be printed by the publisher as a separate ISBN and shrunk wrap with the book, and that moves a new ISBN out of the warehouse.
I see.
And it offsets used book sales. So with my book, my books, there must be an option of 15 or 20 shrink wraps, like the student study guide is shrunk wrap in a package. The Atlas is shrunk wrap in a package. The thing about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Dire Predictions booklet is shrunk wrap as a package. So in your field, it would be something else.
Okay, thank
but,
you.
But be thinking about, ask your editor about shrink wraps and what kind of budgeting would they do for additional things you have in mind, like a topical internet guide that supports your book.
Okay.
That type of thing.
And
of course, as an author, used books are the destroyer of our whole industry because the new book price is driven by the used book efficiency, and that's why textbooks are so expensive.
Mm-hmm.
I think if royalties were paid to publishers and authors for used books, the net price of the new books would probably drop 50%.
Okay.
But there is no revenue stream once the first edition is sold. So all the ancillaries, all the PowerPoints, all the CDs, all the supporting websites, all of that stuff, the instructor's DVD, has to be built into the new book price. And so that drives the price up. So if you think of ways to augment your book that helps students, a shrink wrap is a way to get a new ISBN moving out of the warehouse. But that's a whole other ball of wax that TAA is so strong about. Now, the production editor, the acquisition editor that signs you probably will never read the manuscript. So a production editor, and this could be someone that is even off campus, a subcontractor that they have hired, and I think it's very important to develop a relationship and an ally in this production editor. We've had the same production editor for four books now, and my wife and I, at our own expense, will even fly back to Minnesota and meet with her as in postpartum or postmortem, however you want to view writing a book, to go over what was done and find out ways to improve. So developing a relation there is important, and I put down send flowers when done. But the production editor coordinates the manuscript coming in. Is like the roundhouse in the old railroad days of sorting things out, coordinating the copy edit. The compositing codes are added to your manuscript by the copy editor, and so coordinating all of that, those are the codes that signal how things drop into Quark. To produce the page layout, the hard and soft proofing, PDF files, all that stuff is this production editor. And have them set up an FTP site. And I'm sure most of you have used these, but an FTP site is like a filing cabinet at the publisher or the production editor's house that allows you to submit images, photographs, manuscript materials at high speed from your desktop to their filing cabinet, and it offsets all the attached file business, and you have folders set up, file transfer protocol, FTP site, and most publishers will make those accessible to you. There's something called an F&G, and F&Gs are folded and gathered signatures that are unbound. Let's say your book is 20 signatures. That's 640 pages. A signature is 32 pages. An F&G is a bundle with a rubber band around it of those 20 signatures. And These are sent to the editor and the production editor from the printer, and they're usually a week to 10 days prior to binding. So make sure you're in the loop to get your production editor or your editor to send you overnight express a copy of the FNGs, and you can go through those and sometimes catch an upside down page or something where the signature's out of order or some big thing that the printer can fix prior to binding. If you've never heard of those, ask your editor about them, that you intend to look at FNGs if they'll make them available. You're not doing this to sneak in and look behind their back. You're doing this to help the publisher save money. The goal of all these things I've said in here when I'm talking to an editor is that you're an author with your prospectus that is lowering the overhead of producing your book by doing all this pre-planning stuff. FNGs. Start a corrections file. Now, this means that you take a copy of the book when it's published and you write working copy on it. And then, since you've got your email in the preface, every email you get that asks about a paragraph, that asks about a source, that catches a typo, that catches an error, you start marking up your working copy. And that becomes the correction file. So within a few months of the first printing of your book, you submit to the production editor a list of corrections. Now, these can't be rewriting a page. These can be typos, number errors, spelling errors, something like that. And then those go in so that when your book is printed in its second printing, those corrections appear. That's called a correction file. And so this is how you can catch some of those problems. In the classroom, since students are so intimidated by taking a class, and my God, the author of the book's up there and on the exam, he's going to expect me to know what he knows. And I give points for finding errors. However your point structure works out, that an unlimited number. And this has been very fruitful because it tricks everybody into reading really hard, and it also helps you with your correction file. And it helps melt down that barrier that they're taking the book from the class from the author, because you're admitting there are typos, and it reduces all that friction. Sometimes the correction file is called a reprint file, so whatever your publisher calls it. In other words, the work on your book is never done. There's no way to ever own the final product. It's constantly in motion with preparation file, with correction files, with all of this stuff. I'm listening to myself babble here for 45 minutes, and I hope I'm not just saying all obvious things to all of you, and because I don't want you to have that feeling that you've already discovered all this stuff and already do it. So, again, I acknowledge that all of you could probably conduct this same teleconference. In terms of marketing, the other hand...
Well, before you get to marketing, can I ask a question about ancillary having a contract with a publisher, because sometimes a publisher will ask for money to develop certain ancillaries, and you don't know if you're going to, you end up with no royalties or anything in the end. So one of these things is make sure the contract is, you understand it.
Yeah, I'd say that the student study guide, the instructor's resource manual, the test bank are separate contracts. Separate contract, not part of your book contract. The student study guide is a for sale item, so that can be a royalty item. And if you do a slam bang job on the student study guide, not the usual thing where the publisher hired somebody to do the study guide who didn't care about it and they didn't do anything, but you make a real study guide, a real tutorial, that can be part of your revenue stream. The instructor's resource manual and the test bank are not royalty items. They don't produce revenue. They're not for sale. So those would be, you'd negotiate a work for hire. And so those are important assets in your revenue stream. the work on the CD and all the animations I did, I didn't get – those were done on spec. And they augment and supposedly improve the textbook sales. And so your remuneration comes through that diffused channel. But very good point. Student Study Guide, a royalty contract, and Instructor's Resource Manual, Test Bank, Work for Hire. And please try and do the first Student Study Guide, the first IRM, the first Test Bank yourself, because, again, that sets the style and the template for the future Work for Hires that they will hire, hopefully people you recommend, that will update your Test Bank. But do the first one yourself. That sets the earnest effort and the style for the later ones. And very important on that regard. All right. Jenny sent out and Kim sent out from my teleconference last fall a document about for the teleconference tips and strategies for successfully marketing your textbook. And I think they have the audio of that posted at TA's website. So all of what you're doing in my little presentation here assists marketing. All this is going to assist marketing because you've got such a thought-out, planned, structured book from the get-go. So I would recommend that you attend your national, professional, or statewide meetings. You be present at the sales booth. Again, getting constant feedback is exhausting mentally, but rewarding. I keep a notepad there, and when someone comes up and says, I really like your book, I pull my notepad out and say, if you could change one thing, what would you change? When I go home, what's something you'd like me to read? I see the shocked look on their face when I ask them that. And then when I get their card and I read what they said, I email them back. And that helps the connective tissue. Year after year, I'll have the same people come to the booth and say, I so appreciated you reading what I asked you to read last year. And so consider that as part of the dynamic thing. It's not like a used car lot. And some authors are resistant to this, standing at the booth talking to adopters for some reason like that. But I just find it's part of the creative juice. And if your book does well and whatever, it's, I don't know, it's just a rewarding thing to be present. The Publishers National Sales Meeting, publishers normally have one or two NSMs a year. And so when your book comes out, ask if you can be a speaker there. And they'll bring the hard side or the soft side reps in. You might have to give the same talk 8 or 10 times over a two-day period. But set it up as a PowerPoint. I just find it amazing when I go to these things and the other authors in my area don't do PowerPoints. They just stand up there and talking head. But, you know, make it exciting for the sales reps, something they would remember. You won't get to go to every NSM, but when you have a new front list book or series of books, that's a possibility. And you can meet those reps, give every one of them a business card, and start that connective flow going. I already mentioned about your email in the preface. I used AOL.com because it's short. So sbcglobal.net is short. Some of our academic email addresses are really long. So I've set up a separate one for that. Sometimes there's a thing called an author's marketing questionnaire. And if not, this is something you want to prepare yourself. This is a document that comes out post-print and bind that asks you to comment on your book, on the field, on the sale points that you think your book excels at, on why someone should use the book, what innovations are there, a short review of the competing books that you see that are less than yours. And this is known by a lot of different names, but author's marketing questionnaire is one I've run into. The last couple of books, I haven't been sent one of those, but I sent in my questionnaire anyway. And you can see now that if you did the spreadsheet, if you looked at the competition, as you worked on your book, your author's marketing questionnaire is already done. You're all ready to turn this material over to a sales manager so that they know what to tell their reps to do to sell your book. The possibility that your publisher would allow an author's blog where you can update with current events, new findings, new discoveries. I'll send emails to the national marketing manager of some breakthrough, like West Antarctic ice sheet data shows it's melting faster than they thought, and that will go out to all of the reps. Or if there's a big earthquake in some country, I'll send out a form, and they'll send it to the reps about where they can find the information about that place in the book that's already in the book. Since you have set up the spreadsheet and done the market analysis, these kinds of timely applied aspects will be in your text. If you're a math book, it may be some issue or problem like the satellite having English units instead of metric, and you can send that out to the sales rep. So the author marketing questionnaire and contact. The sales manual copy, this is an e-catalog and sales manual that goes to all the reps, and so you want to ask that they send you the copy of that for your copy edit, because you know the buzzwords in your field, you know what language sounds like your discipline, and the person writing that copy doesn't. So try and, not in an intrusive way, you'll get resistance on all these things, but try and say, if can I help with the sales manual copy or any advertising copy? Have them send you a PDF of a mailing card or something. The idea is to be involved. And then several editions down the road, they know you're involved, and they'll be sending you the color palette, they'll be sending you the cover design, they'll be sending you the sales copy without you even asking. You've programmed the system for an activist author. Revisions, a three-year cycle requires a revision file and that marked-up working copy I talked about, where you enter all the comments you've gotten from students and you end up with a whole marked up version of the book to launch the next edition. So be doing that ahead of time. Be aware that if you have a book that's coming out with, say, a 2010 copyright, your publisher probably has that book done and in stock between January and March of 2009. Even though it's a 2010, when you'll be front listed, so they've pushed back that date earlier and earlier, and I don't like that because it hurts being timely in the textbook. But they're the bosses, so you've got that coming out, you know, like 10 months ahead of your copyright year. So that means the work on that starts during 2008 to have a 2009 in stock for a 2010 book. I know that sounds weird, but when you go to conventions and sit in paper sessions and go to poster sessions and talk to grad students, you're seeing what's ahead in your field. When you're looking at journals, you're kind of seeing where the field's at. When you're looking at other textbooks, you're seeing where the field has been. So one of the valuable things I've run into over the years is earnestly sitting in these paper sessions and taking notes and getting the sniff of what's coming ahead, getting the idea of what's that next turn. I think that's very important. Well, I know I've been blabbing here. Any feedback or thoughts or things that you would add to this list had you presented the teleconference, or things that you'd like me to read?
Hello, Evelyn.
Any comments? Any feedback or questions?
Hello, this is Ross Aiden calling. I'm new to this process, and you've given me a lot of things that hints that I wished I had done. I'm in the middle of it now. Is there one key key thing about organization that you haven't said that would help me get myself organized in this project?
Well, I think for your clipping prep file, using your outline headings for the tabs on the folders so that you go through all of the materials laying all about that relate to content and you're positioning it in the folders rather than having stray piles by subject. So that organizes all your content files. Getting the 30-inch monitor, organizing your computer files so that you can have all of the documents open simultaneously while you're working on a chapter, I think that helps organize the virtual desktop. But all those journals, all that stuff, all of you and me have piled all over our offices.
You bet.
When you set up the outline headings in the folders, hanging files, I have a large vertical filing cabinet in my writing studio, and the entire book files are hanging folders with manila folders in them. That's just a sense of relief there where you're filtering everything through that. That would be my short answer.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for the session. It certainly brings into mind a great number of things that you have to do. Keeping organized is probably one of the most important things. And you work in spits and starts from time to time, and you lose track of things. So I'm glad you emphasized that organization aspect.
Thank you. I really can't stress that enough, that writing a textbook, or even a novel, I guess, but it's not some haphazard thing where you go in and the creative juices flow. You've got to build a whole scaffolding, just like the studs in a building, and put up the drywall and paint the plaster. And, I mean, you structurally set that up. The byproduct of that is it organizes your life. It organizes the teaching. It organizes relationship with family because your writing studio is convenient. And you get up to teach and you find the flow of words is much more abundant because you've been massaging words in your manuscript. So if you allow this occupation that you've chosen to do, to be a writer, the more it infuses the rest of your professional life, the more benefits and payoff occur, plus the books get done well. Anything else? My email is on there, so you can write me, and I'll be presenting at the TAA meeting in San Antonio a couple of papers, and I'd love to meet you or have you come up and talk. They have me start off every TAA conference by giving a geoprimer about the local area so that you get a quick 25-minute view of what's there. So I'll see you at that opening session if there aren't any further questions. Please remember what I said about this is a personal statement that each of you could probably present this same teleconference. I haven't figured out any special mysteries. I'm just a student trying to flesh this out, and I'm going to look up the LaTeX thing, and it's the Edison approach to writing where you set everything up and then the inspiration. So thank you very much.
This has been an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.